Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You're listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Alva Ray, and my colleagues Anusha Kalyan and Stephen Bush. In this episode, we talk about the new coronavirus restrictions, and you ask us, what do you think of the covert human intelligence sources bill, and should Labour have voted against it?
So we're recording on a day when it's been announced that there'll be more lockdown measures for more parts of England arriving on Monday. And already in Scotland, Edinburgh and Glasgow and its central belt will have restaurants, pubs and bars closed from 6 p.m. from Friday. So that means that most of the country, or a lot of the country, with many parts of England to follow, will be under stricter lockdowns. And this has been announced with a new three-tier system, giving different levels of graveness to the restrictions for each tier. But one of the controversies of these announcements is that it appears that leaders in areas of the north where these measures will have an impact hadn't seemed to have been consulted before the story was briefed and reported on the front page of The Times. Stephen, what implications does the way that this news has come out have for the lockdown measures themselves?
Well, I think so. I think the fact of the leaking themselves is kind of like, is outside the control of the government, right? Like, government is this huge thing where loads of people talk to people, and like, any kind of consultative process will lead to leaks, which I mean is why, and I mean this with the greatest respect to the Times, you've got a lot of detail than no one had before, but it's why then basically it's almost like it's been like every like news outlet's turn to get this scoop about us moving to a more simple system where you're like, oh, I'm in a tier one area, I'm in a tier two area, I'm in a tier three area. Like, everyone has had a version of this scoop, basically. So that's not because of like deliberate leaking, that's just because of the way that like the state operates. What is revealing is that this is the first time that most of these local government people have heard of it. And then, so in another way, like, the revealing thing is not so much that it leaks to the Times, it's not leaking to the Yorkshire Post, the Manchester Evening News. And when it does leak, it has leaked to some of those outlets, actually. When it has leaked to those outlets, it's leaked to them via their Westminster end, right? Whereas the reason why this stuff unavoidably leaks is, right, you get, like, a civil servant consulting on it, and then they say to their mate, oh, you'd never guess what I'm working on. And then their mate, like, you know, goes for a scone or something with the political editor of a current affairs magazine, and they go, oh, that's very interesting. So what are your plans about lockdown? And they go, oh, well, we're moving towards tiers. But what's really striking is the reason why these leaks are only happening at the London end is because we have an incredibly centralising government that is not particularly interested in consulting. Yeah, I mean, it's not even particularly interested in consulting the bits of local government it directly controls, let alone the bits that it doesn't. I mean, yeah, one of the, like, I think, fascinating sort of political choices is that they're not even providing a... I'm not saying it would be defensible if, like, they were providing a Rolls-Royce level of briefing and understanding to, like, Ben Houchin and Andy Street. But you would at least kind of understand it from a raw political perspective. This is a kind of more sort of, we just have distaste for local government, and we, yeah, our instinct is command and control. And I think that's one of the reasons... Well, I mean, I guess the big question is, what is the... In 19 of the 20 areas that have been in lockdown for longer than 2 months, the rates are continuing to climb. And it's not clear why that is, but I mean, it's a bit like what we were saying a couple of weeks ago about, like, well, it can't have helped that instead of, like, doing test and trace, we had, like, the internal market bill, we didn't extend the transition period. And it's kind of like that, right? It can't help, can it? Logically, it must increase the confusion that the local government, which is really the only, like, final mile bit of the British state other than the benefit system, is like, what's going on? Tears, first I've heard of it.
Yeah, I mean, what you said about control from the centre, I think, is really true. And it makes me think that this government is just, again, I know we've spoken about this, but there's such a gap between the myth that it has of itself and the way that it actually acts. So, you know, I know that briefings and leaks and things can happen in all sorts of ways that are beyond the control of the people who actually are in charge of forming and or announcing the policies. But it's just so interesting that when these stories come out, it does seem that there's very, very little warning or consultation or just, you know, a sliver of respect for local government and the mayors who will ultimately be in charge of these policies actually being effective. You know, you need their goodwill. And it's just so interesting from a government that, I mean, in the Tory manifesto in 2019, there was a line that said that we don't believe everything should flow from Whitehall. And, you know, it should be the end of government from London. And we should trust our communities to decide, you know, what's best for themselves. And that was in the part about the levelling up agenda, which was a key plank of what they wanted people to vote for them on. And just the way that they treat local government, the way that they've funded it as well, and the way that they leave out the mayors from decision making and leader of councils in areas where local lockdowns are going to come into play. And, you know, this has happened throughout the coronavirus crisis. You know, they promised that they would give whatever it takes or whatever is necessary to councils, but they haven't reimbursed everything, and they've rowed back from that. As well as that, they had some problems giving detailed coronavirus case data to local authorities. You know, do you remember in the first sort of times of local lockdowns looming, councils weren't in receipt of all of the facts about the data in their local areas? That was because of an ever centralizing government. Regardless of what these leaks or the actual tier system means for the local lockdown measures, the way that this government has gone about it just reveals so much about it. You know, the mask is just slipping from this government that pretends that it cares about these areas that perhaps traditionally weren't represented by Conservative governments, but it doesn't. It just doesn't.
I mean, I suppose the difficult thing with discussing this on a podcast is that it feels like the problems are quite obvious to anyone who's been following the news at all. And the implications in the long term are also quite obvious, but it doesn't really make them any less serious. I thought that Lisa Nandy, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, did a very good interview on this on Robert Peston's programme last night on ITV, where she was talking, I think this will be a theme in the coming weeks and months, and possibly a huge one in the next decade as we look back on how the government handled this. But she was sort of zooming out on the local lockdowns and how they have been implemented to talk sort of more generally about a north-south divide and the growing feeling of resentment in those communities. I think on a personal level, it stresses me out a bit because my geography of the north of England is really, really bad. And I feel like I'm not as bad a culprit as some people because I'm not from the south of England or from London, even though I now live here. But I think, you know, there is a general theme of people referring to the north like some sort of unknown blob and kind of struggling to differentiate between particular areas and the particular measures that have been imposed in different parts. And I think that maybe has a small part to play, dare I suggest, in the way politicians really, really struggle to sort of say the difference between what you can do in a pub in Wigan and a pub elsewhere, as like Boris Johnson and other ministers have really struggled. But yeah, I think that it is just an irony of this situation that this was the government's stated aim before the election. And in some ways, you know, one of the big drivers of all our big political moves in the last decade or so, that there is this, you know, growing feeling of resentment, people feeling increasingly detached from the centre of power in this country. And in a way, you know, this government stood on a platform of trying to of showing that they understood that feeling of disconnect and trying to address it. But this is just massively exacerbating that problem, not just in terms of people feeling like they're, you know, they're being patronized, that their local governments aren't being listened to, local leaders aren't being listened to, that they're having a much worse time than people in, you know, well, at the moment, than people in London, you know, they can't go to the pub or whatever. But I think also like the economic impact of it, that, I mean, things are maybe changing slightly because it's different demographics that are catching the virus. It's sort of younger people, which is seeing the biggest increase in cases at the moment, even though that's changing slightly again. But certainly at the beginning, it was, you know, it was just this double-edged sword of people who were from sort of the most disadvantaged socioeconomic groups who were most likely to be catching the virus, but also to be living in communities that were worst affected by it. And so I just think that, you know, this ultimately will just have the effect of leveling down areas that were already leveled down. And Stephen, you mentioned in a piece, I think within the past week, that the government's saving grace is that plenty of people still ultimately believe that the coronavirus poses such a big challenge that even though they haven't done a great job, lots of people don't actually fundamentally believe that any government could have done it much better. So maybe people will, to a degree, think that this was a kind of inevitable consequence of the virus, but it just is nevertheless just like the cruel irony of a government trying to address all these problems of you know, a huge disconnect in poorer parts of the country and in parts further literally from London, and then a virus that is kind of ravaging those areas and just widening that gap between London and the north, that blob.
So this morning when I was putting the email together, it was one of the things I was actually really struck, like how hard it was to find outwit of, yeah, like the number of outlets where it was just like the north.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one, you know, I mean, I have, you know, very good friends, some of whom actually listen to this podcast, but who will bore on for ages about the fact that they don't believe than any of the cities that are in this lockdown are actually in the north. But it's just like the thing where it's like, it's not, it does reflect the kind of like, which is both like a product of deliberate media choices, but it also, you know, people do take their cue from leaders, right, both inside institutions and without them. And the fact that visibly it's, oh yeah, the north, that's a thing that's been locked down, has clearly been transmitted up. But I also suspect that is one of the reasons why, as you've shown in your work, and it's one of the reasons why people aren't observing self-isolation is they literally can't afford to. But I suspect the other thing is that because where these lockdowns are actually happening is being communicated so badly, partly by the government, but also just partly by us as an industry, it must be a factor as well. And then you add to that the fact that, you know, everyone is tired and miserable of lockdown, and kind of no wonder it's not happening.
On a related note, I think another thing I noticed similarly when I'm doing Morning Call in particular is the difficulty when you read news pieces on places like the BBC or any other outlet. It's not really specifically a BBC problem. Like the difficulty working out what people mean when they say this country. It's definitely a problem that news outlets refer to the United Kingdom when they mean England and vice versa. But mainly in the other direction, where you kind of assume while you're writing your copy that something the government has said refers to the whole of the United Kingdom, but it doesn't. It only refers to England. And it's amazing. I think that maybe I'm just being cynical, but I think that possibly copywriters deliberately say this country to obscure the fact that they don't actually know whether things apply to only England or the UK. And that, I suppose, is symptomatic of the broader problem, because I know I find it annoying, but I also know that lots of our readers want us to be really specific about where specific rules apply. And certainly I wonder about the way that whether people living in the north also just feel in general like their concerns haven't been amplified to a sufficient degree, because everyone who's reporting on these things is doing so out of London. And I'm sure that we're all guilty of it. And it's possibly unavoidable that if you are reporting from London and also not leaving the house much, the way most of us aren't at the moment, you're kind of inevitably coloured, your reporting is coloured by your own experience. And you're seeing it through the prism of the, you know, the experience of the virus in London. And maybe, you know, since that is, you know, reflected just across media outlets, except for, you know, their individual, you know, Northern reporter, I think maybe people are also feeling that disconnect when they see their situation being reported on as though it's kind of other and not something that, you know, people are experiencing on the ground when they're talking about it.
I do think, you know, some of that is inevitable for the reasons you described, but I do also think it's fascinating because it's both the biggest argument for Scottish independence, but it's also crucially their biggest strategic asset. In the, one of the reasons why Nicola Sturgeon is seen as having handled the crisis better than Boris Johnson is Scotland does have a lower death rate. It's still very high. Like, Wales actually does have quite a low death rate per capita, but they have made decisions better, and their communications just have been better. Right, you can see that through the very simple metric of asking people in the two countries whether or not they understand, about their level of understanding of the rules in place. But I do think the other thing is that because, as you say, this kind of like this country thing where I suspect you're right, that is a cheat where people kind of go like, well, I'm not technically wrong if I write this country, does mean that as well as the things that they have done undoubtedly better, from the small things like maintaining their press conferences, Sturgeon sort of wearing a mask at all times and demonstrating that very early on, they also do just have this thing where because Scotland is ignored because the majority of eyeballs, and even the BBC, which, you can argue shouldn't do this, but is led by eyeballs, doesn't cover what goes on in Scotland on, it's British, but I mean, it's English thing, and that kind of speaks to the central problem of our constitutional settlement, right? Which is it's just really hard to keep your polity together when, like, one part of your country is, like, so much larger than the others. And it does lead to both asymmetries of power, but also, crucially, asymmetries of scrutiny, which I think we are both seeing how that means the government gets an easy ride on in terms of some of its behaviour, but I also think probably makes it harder for them to succeed in their political project of keeping Scotland in the United Kingdom.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
This question is from Jake Pitt. Thanks, Jake. What do you think of the Covert Human Intelligence Sources Criminal Conduct Bill? And should Labour have voted against it? So this bill, I think it was the second reading earlier this week. And I think that it constituted the second rebellion on the Labour benches as well, if that's right. But 20 Labour MPs rebelled against their party leadership and voted against this bill, whereas Keir Starmer wanted them to abstain.
Yeah, so this is the purpose of the bill. Basically, there are two arguable headlines on this bill, right? Headline one is this bill regulates the activities of the security services when they are engaging in law breaking. So to use something I've written and brought on about in this podcast before, spy cops, when you had the police infiltrating political groups, predominantly left-wing groups, you had police officers who impregnated women while they were under deep cover. The women in question, in my view, rightly believe they did not have the ability to give informed consent, and there's a huge legal case on it, right? So there's that element of it, like the kind of regulation of all of that, and arguably that's one headline you could say that these measures have. And headline two is basically, well, it makes it easier rather than harder for people to engage in, for the security service to engage in that kind of bad behaviour. Now, the Labour Party has whipped to abstain on it. Yeah, their kind of headline argument is, well, because broadly they think it's useful and worthwhile to regulate the security services in this space, which I think is true, but they do not agree with the bill as it stands, and so they will seek to amend in committee stage. Now, of course, the political rationale is, and they want to be able to have the argument of going, we're not in favour of, criminalising our boys or binding the security services' hands behind their back, we had concerns, which is why we, And that's like the that's the actual political argument for it, which I think, like, in a vacuum, open and shut makes sense. I guess my objection to it is that I think the direction of travel is at some point in this parliament, there is going to come a bill to take us out of the ECHR, or at the very least to repeal parts of the Human Rights Act. Seeing as at that point the Labour Party is going to be having all of these fights it doesn't want to have regardless, right? Because, like, even if you decide then, like, you think it is okay to abstain on whether or not on repealing the Human Rights Act, the parliamentary party is not in that place, let alone the party in the country. So the Labour leadership can't be in that place. So I kind of think then, like, the point of abstaining to not have a fight is if you can actually not have the fight. Whereas if you're going to have it, you might as well just have it, rather than kind of being like, we're not having it, we're not having it, we're not having it. Oh yeah, now we're having it anyway. It's sort of my kind of like view, but, you know, I don't know what you two sort of make of it.
Well, so I think that this points to a bigger theme that we're going to see more of in this parliament, of both parties playing politics, basically, with just the way that their opposing party votes on things. So even before this, Conservative MPs speaking about the challenges ahead for this government, all actually, like the ones I've been speaking to, all similarly expressed the same kind of concern over the tricky politics of Labour putting down opposition day votes that the government has to, that the Conservative MPs feel obliged to vote against. They basically have to vote against. They're not going to randomly vote in Labour legislation. But it creates very tricky headlines for them that, you know, it's basically the Conservatives voted against this unequivocally good thing. Then on social media, that can be kind of misconstrued. And then by the same token, now the Conservatives have become, I don't think this is entirely new, like it has happened before, but the Conservatives in their social media game have become very, very good at saying Labour voted against X, Labour, you know, Labour doesn't support Y. So, you know, for example, by voting against the internal market bill, Labour was, you know, voting, was siding with the EU over Britain or whatever, because it didn't vote against some, it didn't vote for the bill. This is clearly just going to be a factor of our political conversation for the next few years, that people will look at how parties voted and also how individual MPs voted without necessarily understanding the full context of whipping. And so we've already seen on sites like, you know, They Work For You, where you can see how an MP has voted on something, and that's used as a gauge of their position on all sorts of issues. It often paints a kind of partial picture, because you need to know the full context of, you know, whether they were planning an amendment. Did they vote against that amendment because the government had another one that incorporated those things, but, you know, improved on them? You know, did they vote against that thing that looks like a good thing because it was actually totally unworkable or beyond the scope of that bill? There's so many sort of more boring reasons why MPs or parties as wholes wouldn't vote for something. And I think it all ties into the politics of that. But in this specific case, it's been interesting, like Labour members, I know, you know, Labour Twitter is not the real world and not even necessarily the whole of the Labour Party, but people have been having lots of, I think, quite good faith and serious debates about this, because, you know, the argument from the Labour leadership is that you should abstain on this because ultimately, like you were saying, Stephen, ultimately it is a good thing to have legislation on this and to clarify it, but they're not happy with all of it. So they plan on, you know, abstaining and then bringing in amendments later on to improve it. But as has been pointed out, Labour equally could have voted against it and it would still have moved through the Commons. And then they could still have tabled amendments at a later point. So it is actually more about the optics of it. And no one has put it in these stark terms, so feel free to jump in, either of you, if you fundamentally disagree. But it is basically that the Labour leadership doesn't want to look like it is, you know, not supporting the intelligence services. It's like, you know, that it's being insufficiently patriotic and basically doesn't want to have the fight.
That was kind of the impression that I got with this covert intelligence bill, and also with last month's overseas operations bill, which kind of covered sort of a similar theme, you know, about prosecutions for British soldiers who have been serving abroad and sort of trying to protect them from that. I do think that Keir Starmer's trying to walk a sort of tightly balanced line for bills like this, particularly when they have human rights implications, or at least human rights groups and the socialist campaign group MPs who have voted against these bills have brought up sort of problems in terms of human rights abuses that potentially could arise from voting for these bills, because you can see that that is a wedge that the Tory party is trying to create both between themselves and the Labour Party, but also trying to sort of exploit the divisions within the Labour Party on these issues. I thought that the sort of main kind of culture warsy section of Boris Johnson's conference speech this week was when he tried to sort of palm off the description on Priti Patel, but he was talking about sort of lefty lawyers and do-gooders, and you can tell that he's kind of trying to allude to that human rights. I suppose they would see it as a kind of blob, you know, people who want to defend the rights of the kind of issues that have been brought up in bills like these. And so you can kind of tell that that's sort of a rich seam for the Conservative Party, or at least it views it as a rich seam to try and pursue. The suggestion is that the thinking behind abstaining on bills like this, and also trying to avoid a fight with your own MPs on them unsuccessfully, is there's a further reason behind that, and it's a political reason.
And it's just that fundamental question, like, what do you do if you're the Labour Party in opposition, when ultimately it doesn't matter whether you vote against something or abstain on it, because unless something changes on the Tory benches, ultimately, you know, it's not going to make a difference. So it's very much just what you're saying to the country and to Parliament about your values as a party. And that's where the fundamental disagreement is. But, you know, I think that we've seen some of the younger MPs to the left who joined Labour in the 2019 intake, like Zara Sultana and Nadia Whittam, coming into their own really in the past few weeks. They've already had quite a big profile, but I think that people towards the centre of the Labour Party have been a bit sneering at them on occasion, because they're kind of young and sincere and have got some kind of aspects of the detail occasionally wrong. But on this, you know, they're in a position where everyone knows where they stand. They're not doing Keir Starmer's grand old strategy of trying to unite a diverse voter coalition. They're just sort of representing the values that they were elected on, and people know what kind of politics they already have. So they're very much able to just stand up in the House of Commons and say, well, no, I'm not going to let this fly. This is not what I believe in. It's not what we as Labour stand for. And I think both of them, I thought Zara Sultana's speech, where she invoked the 1989 murder of Pat Finucane, who was a lawyer from Belfast, who was shot by loyalist paramilitaries. And it turned out that had been in collusion with the British state. I thought her speech on it was really detailed and really an example of her at her strongest. And yeah, and as you say, Stephen, like, that was, I think, the strongest example of what a problem Keir Starmer would have over this, because you ultimately don't want to give the Conservatives, or maybe you do, but you don't want to give the Conservatives the easy Facebook thing of, you know, Labour just voted against our troops or our veterans or our intelligence services. But like, that's also plainly like not where the party is. And you can see a very principled speech from Zara Sultana sort of making the case very clearly for why it's potentially not a good position for Labour to be in.
Yeah, and I say this as someone who thinks that, like, Labour should have voted against the bill. But I think that from the position of what they want to achieve politically and electorally, actually the Zara Sultana stuff is fine, because it's like that core of 20 sort of ultras within the campaign group who do not have the ability to launch a leadership challenge and have lost. And because, like, the vast majority of political journalism is not about policy, about horse race, it gives, like, an opportunity. To the extent anyone normal notices this, the thing that people notice is minority of Labour MPs rebel against Labour leadership having robust position on security, right? That is a win in the narrow confines of what they want to achieve with these votes. The problem with other stuff, right, is basically that looks great provided you win, right? It's the same with, like, David Cameron's various fights on social issues with his right. That was fine because he won those fights. But yeah, and this is like the difference between this and, say, the welfare bill, right? The reason why the welfare bill abstention from a political tactics perspective didn't work, parking and both of these, the arguments about the rightness of them, right, where it was the exact same political calculation, is broadly Harriet Holman couldn't take the PLP with her. There was a rebellion significantly outside the usual suspects. And as a result of that, the walls came tumbling down.
Listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Alva Ray, and my colleagues Anusha Kellyan and Stephen Bush. We're produced by Nick Hilton, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.